Lowe's has the brands pros trust to get the job done. You can now shop new Catalyst fencing solutions and save big when you do. 10% off when you buy in bulk. Plus, save $180 on a DeWalt 12-inch dual bevel sliding compound miter saw. Now just $449. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/6 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hey, strangers, before we jump into today's episode, I wanted to tell you about a live show I'm doing on March 15th, which has absolutely nothing to do with Strange and Unexplained. Daisy and Jordan's Sunday Brunch of Shame is a comedy show my comedy partner Jordan Kai Burnett and I have been doing since 2014. This is our first live show in about 8 years. If you're in the New York area, you can get tickets for the live show, but if you can't make it into the city, you can live stream it from anywhere in the world. March 15th at 1 p.m. Eastern at the Laurie Beachman Theater in New York City. Head to thebeachman.com for tickets. That's thebeechman.com for tickets. See you there. Are fairies and goblins and cryptids real? Or are they just the fancies of creative people? How many people have been fooled by the seeming magic of a firefly or by inexplicable sounds in the night? How many make-believe stories have been believed and passed down, turning into history on their way? When does a story become folklore? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I am neutral on clowns. I know there are those who find them universally creepy. I think Pennywise and John Wayne Gacy helped turn clowns from lovable pie-tossing, water-squirting, flower-wearing, fun-loving rapscallions into the stuff of nightmares. I got to be a clown once in the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus. I feel like maybe I've talked about that before on this show, but it's been 7,000 years, and who can keep track anymore? It was for a charity thing, and I got all dressed up and rode on an elephant and did the clown car routine with the famous Ringling Brothers clowns. And yes, yes, I know circuses are problematic. I was 12 years old. My point is, I am not one of those folks who suffers from coulrophobia, fear of clowns. I do not find clowns creepy or threatening by themselves. But God bless any brave soul who decides to be a clown for a living these days. Especially a birthday party clown. One wrong look in the wrong direction, and Olivia Benson will have your ass in interrogation room number one faster than you can say... So just imagine two children off exploring in the wild, as children used to be able to do, coming across a clown who invites them into their hovel and then sends them home with truly bizarre stories. Imagine the YouTuber outrage. Imagine the headlines. Imagine the pitchforks. Just south of the mainland of England, there lies a tiny island, just 147 square miles, called the Isle of Wight. On the east coast of the Isle of Wight is a tiny little town called Sandown, which apparently meant sandy village in ye olde English. But before it was a sandy village, Sandown, and indeed likely all of the Isle of Wight, was a military site, as it offered perhaps a small buffer between invading armies and the mainland. When I say small, I mean I imagine ships could just go around it, though I suppose they'd be hit by a barrage of artillery from the small military island. By the late 1700s, though, the first non-military buildings were going up in Sandown, and by the late 1800s, it was a popular vacation spot hosting what is now one of the oldest summer carnivals in the UK. Sandown has had its brushes with fame. German royalty, Crown Prince Frederick and Princess Victoria with their children, would spend vacations at Sandown. Charles Darwin wrote the abstract that would become On the Origin of Species in a hotel in Sandown in 1858. Literary creep Lewis Carroll spent some time in the village in the 1870s and wrote The Hunting of the Snark there, dedicating it to a very young girl named Gertrude, whom he met while writing it. And this is apropos of nothing, per se, I just think it's important to note. Gertrude was 9 years old when she was friends with 43-year-old Carol. Wikipedia calls Gertrude Carol's most important child friend after Alice Little, who was 10 years old when she was Carol's child friend. Child friend. Okay. Anyway. Composer Richard Strauss spent two summers in Sandown in 1902 and 1903 writing a symphony that would become, at least in part, his opera Der Rosenkavalier. Today, according to a piece on CuriousArchive.com, Sandown boasts, quote, various attractions, including a wildlife sanctuary and a dinosaur museum. The area is rich with dinosaur bones, and a quintessential Victorian pier with a large arcade and beautiful views of the cliffs and sea, end quote. Sandown is also home to the Shanklin and Sandown Golf Club, a small nine-hole course completed in 1903, and it is here that our story takes place. In May of 1973, two children, about 7 years old, were wandering the links at the Shanklin and Sandown Golf Club when, according to an article in the January-February 1978 edition of the Bufora, the British UFO Research Association journal, they, quote, heard a weird wailing noise not unlike an ambulance siren. They followed it across the golf links and through a hedge leading to a swampy meadow adjacent to little-used Sandown Airport. The noise ceased, end quote. The young girl, who is known in this story as Faye, though that is apparently not her real name, and her playmate, an unnamed boy, were crossing a small wooden footbridge over what I believe golfers might call a water hazard, otherwise known as a small brook, when, quote, a blue-gloved hand appeared from under the bridge and a strange figure emerged, end quote. Just right away, stranger, I'm going to have to go ahead and say nope, no thank you, not today, Bob. Not a blue-gloved hand appearing from under a footbridge. Quote, the figure fumbled with a book, dropped it in the water, then splashed about to retrieve it. The two then watched the figure enter a metallic hut similar to those used on building sites, except that it had no windows. It moved along with a strange hopping motion with knees raised high, end quote. Apparently, the children then wandered off. I'm surprised they didn't run screaming, but no sooner than they were about 50 yards away that the strange figure, quote, reappeared carrying a black-knobbed microphone with a white flex attached. The wailing noise immediately returned, this time being so loud that the boy was scared and began to run away. The noise ceased and he spoke into the microphone, and although so far off, the children could hear his voice as clearly as though he were right near them. Hello. Are you still there? He asked. And in response to what sounded a friendly tone, they ventured close enough to speak to the oddly attired person, end quote. The word person is in quotation marks here, stranger, because the children couldn't be sure what exactly this thing was. Also, just tell your children to please not approach a figure that they first witnessed emerging from a brook under a footbridge. Especially not when this is how the figure was described in the Bufora article. Quote, he was nearly 7 feet tall and had no neck, for his head appeared to be wedged straight onto his shoulders. He wore a yellow pointed hat which interlocked with the red collar of a green tunic. A round black knob was affixed to the top of his hat, and wooden antennae were attached to either side. The face had triangular markings for eyes, a brown square of a nose, and motionless yellow lips. Other round markings were on his paper-white cheeks, and a fringe of red hair fell onto his forehead. Wooden slats protruded from his sleeves and from below his white trousers. End quote. He then wrote something in a notebook and tried to hand it to the children. The boy was not having any of it, but Faye was apparently down to clown and read the words he'd written. She said the words were not laid out in conventional sequence, but despite that, she interpreted the message as reading, quote, hello, and I am all color Sam, end quote. And I am all set. The children, though, were not all set and moved closer to all colors Sam. He could speak, though he couldn't move his lips, probably because, if I could venture a guess, his face was actually a mask. He apparently asked the children about themselves, though there are no details as to what exactly he asked. The kids asked him about his clothes, which were tattered. He explained that he only had one outfit. Then they asked if he was really a man, to which he replied with a chuckle and said, no. Quote, they also asked if he was a ghost. The vague reply was, well, not really, but I am in an odd sort of way. What are you then? They continued, but only obtained the answer, you know, with no further explanation. End quote. No, bro, I don't know. Like, at all. He then told them he had no name, even though he'd introduced himself on paper as Sam. No Name, All Colors Sam told them there were others like him, and that he was generally afraid of people and would fight back if provoked. Despite this, however, he was apparently like, hey, you want to come inside my creepy little hut? To which the children replied, of course. The children crawled through a flap into the windowless shed to find it had both an upstairs and a downstairs. The downstairs was spacious and wallpapered with wooden furniture and some dials on the walls. No Name, All Colors Sam, aka Sam for our purposes, took off his hat, quote, to reveal round white ears and sparse brown hair, end quote. He told the children he lived on foraged berries and filtered river water. He then took out a berry and, quote, placed the berry in his ear, thrust his head forward, and caused the berry to disappear and reappear at one of his odd eyes. Repeating the process, the berry traveled to his mouth. End quote. The article editorializes here with this, quote, a possible explanation could be that he was wearing some kind of protective mask and analyzing the berry to check it wasn't poisonous, end quote. I mean, sure. Possibly he was wearing some kind of space-age mask that required putting a berry in his ear, having it appear in his eye, and then travel to his mouth while somehow being analyzed for poison. Okay. Also, your grandpa really did make a quarter appear like magic from behind your ear. After about a half an hour or so of chatting with Sam, because children are notoriously very good at gauging the passage of time, they said goodbye and ran off through the golf course and told the first adult they came across that they'd just seen a ghost. This guy apparently just laughed them off, because of course he did, because what else are you supposed to do when 2 7-year-olds tell you they've just seen a ghost? Take them seriously? I don't think so. Also, it seems this person was never reached for comment. And then, despite their urgency in telling the first adult they encountered, Faye waited 3 weeks to tell her father about the experience. Faye's father, identified only as Mr. Y, at first dismissed the story as the creation of a couple of children with overactive imaginations. However, the article continues, quote, there was such an extraordinary amount of detail, however, which included the further point that the creature clearly had only 3 fingers on each blue-gloved hand and 3 toes on his bare white feet, making a deliberate hoax somewhat difficult. And indeed, why go to all that trouble? End quote. I mean, they're 7-year-old children with nothing else to do. I hardly think coming up with details about a weird clown guy who lives in a shed at the edge of a golf course and puts berries in his ears is a lot of trouble. Sounds like a reasonable use of an afternoon to me. The article in Bufora, which was indeed the only outlet that covered this story at the time, said that Faye's dad admitted her story could have sprung from, quote, some connection with his own previous experiences. What were those experiences? Well, Mr. Y, it seems, was no stranger to strange encounters from the unknown. 3 years before his daughter came to him with her tale of Sam, in 1970, Mr. Y claimed to have seen, quote, a large, multi-lit aircraft. It looked enormous as it flew over swampy terrain. The object hovered apparently aimlessly over the swampy margins of the River Yar. A wide ring of seven or more lights could be seen, each of them a large and clearly defined sphere, like a bright red cherry, and interspersed with a turquoise and a white light. No sound could be heard. End quote. He claimed the craft flew alongside his car for some time, and then, quote, it cut across about 300 yards behind him and dropped slowly, meandering above distant hedges, now appearing smaller, with the number of red lights reduced to four, which seemed to rotate slowly, end quote. He then claimed to have used his flashlight to communicate with the thing, quote, during which time the object weaved backwards and forwards. When he reached his destination, the red lights were still there, and he left his own rear lights on to face the object. Coming out of the house, his friend could see the thing also playing hide-and-seek between the treetops. As he continued on to ride, the lights were lost to view, and our witness saw them no more, end quote. And this was not the only time. He also claimed to have seen red lights in the sky on several subsequent occasions, which he said would follow him, quote, as though checking his movements. Why alien beings would be checking on this one random dude's movements, I can't say. Maybe he looked real good in his 501s? I don't know. And then, 2 years later, Mr. Y had a much scarier encounter. I don't exactly understand, but the piece says he was, quote, perched on the cliffside at Compton Bay, having been driven there by an unexpected tidal surge, seemingly caused, in part at least, by some form of droning underwater craft, end quote. So he was driven to the cliffside by a tidal surge? I don't get it. Anyway, then he saw two yellow lights, quote, peering up at me like the eyes of some horrible sea monster. He guessed the eyes were not much more than 40 feet away and were just below the surface of the sea, like a sort of periscope. They disappeared, and as the tide gradually subsided, Mr. Y was able to get back to his car and drive home, end quote. Now, Mr. Y claimed to have never told his daughter about these encounters, so I suppose we're meant to believe that Mr. Y and Faye were both separately singled out by otherworldly beings for some reason. Possible. Another possibility is that Mr. Y was someone who believed in this kind of stuff and regaled his daughter with fabulous tales of the fantastic things he'd seen, and she was like, hey, me too. Mr. Y also said that Faye told him that two workers had been nearby fixing a post during her encounter with Sam, and they acted as though they didn't see Sam. He seems to be offering this as further proof that Faye was telling the truth. Sure. Or the workers acted as though they didn't see Sam because there was no Sam and Faye was making the whole thing up. It's important to consider the source, or in this case, the sources. First, you have a 7-year-old girl and her unnamed playmate who allegedly waited 3 weeks to tell her father about this incredible encounter. Then you have the father who had allegedly had his own encounters. And now consider that Mr. Y didn't even recount the story until 5 years after it allegedly happened. Norman Oliver, who wrote the piece for Bufora, says that Mr. Y gave him a, quote, very complete dossier of events. Of necessity, these have had to be encapsulated. Nevertheless, they make interesting reading, end quote. In other words, there's no way to verify any of this, but it's a nifty story in any case, so take it or leave it. The dossier no longer exists, and Oliver, it seems, never shared it or any notes with anyone, so we only have their word to go on. Oliver ends the piece this way. Quote, Mr. Y visited the spot, but could find no metal hut anywhere in sight, nor any indication of one. Not really surprising, no matter in what light one views the children's story. For to make a comparison, how often are traces found in reported UFO landings? The case rests. End quote. But, of course, the case did not rest there, because here we are more than 50 years later talking about it, and, as these stories are wont to do, it continues to evolve. Interest in Sam the Sandown Clown picked up last year in 2025 when folklorist Paul A.T. Wilson gave a presentation titled The Sandown Clown Declassified at a new venue on the Isle of Wight. A piece for On the Wight, a website dedicated to all things Isle of Wight, reported that in his presentation, Paul, quote, explained that he'd been in contact in 2018-2019 with one of the children, Faye, who had reported seeing Sam the Sandown Clown in 1973. Paul showed what he said was some of the original artwork created by the children, as well as read out excerpts from the report submitted to Bufora by one of their fathers some years after the incident, end quote. Paul followed this presentation up with quite a run of interviews on podcasts last year, a couple of which I begrudgingly listened to. Here's Paul Wilson's story as he tells it, paraphrased by me. Firstly, it's important to know that the Sandown Clown was not a well-known piece of lore, even on the Isle of Wight, but Paul's father knew the story and told Paul about it when he was quite young. Paul became a folklorist. Apparently, a few people had come to him claiming to be Fae over the years, but he didn't believe them for one reason or another. But in 2018 or 19, a young woman came to him and said she was Fae's daughter. She said Fae had an update. Paul met Faye and for some reason this time believed her to be the genuine article. Faye told him that she had had a handful more encounters with Sam after the initial one in 1973. The first time was in 1982 when Faye was 16 at a bus stop. While walking to the bus stop, Faye heard a faint buzz and began to get nervous, feeling like something was wrong, and started walking faster. Then she heard something in the forest and saw the same being she saw when she was 7, but his clothes were cleaner and less tattered. He had neither a notebook nor a microphone this time, but instead he carried a wand that looked like a flute with a bunch of buttons on it. Faye told Paul that she wasn't afraid of Sam, but rather that she felt almost at peace. The thing he was holding was used to draw symbols and shapes in the air that made no sense to her. Paul's description of these air drawings is not tremendously helpful. He says they were like chalk on a sidewalk, but they would dissolve quickly. I don't know what the symbols meant, and apparently neither did Faye, I guess. Faye said his voice was less robotic than it had been in 73 and clearer. He told Faye that he'd been keeping an eye on her. He told her he would visit her a total of 4 times, including that one, I believe, if that was okay with her. It must have been okay with her because the next visit came a year later when Faye was hanging out with some friends at a park, drinking and smoking, though Faye assured Paul she was not drunk. She said an odd smell first caught her attention. It was the smell of earth that quickly changed into the smell of burning leaves. Suddenly, her friends were gone, but she was still there in the park. She described it almost as if a veil had been laid over the world around her. The colors of the grass and the trees were deeper. The shadows that the trees cast were longer and exaggerated, and there was no sound at all. It was completely silent. She said it was like someone had just turned down her reality. And that's when she saw Sam. This time, he was with others like him, and she said they seemed to be chatting with each other in a language she couldn't understand, like listening to someone speak while you were underwater. Then, tall, lighted shapes appeared that looked like doors. Sam led her down the path to the doors. Quote, each of them had a unique feel about them, like their own energy radiating off all of them. Some felt joyous and felt kind and welcoming, like there was just peace beyond the doorway, end quote. Others felt cold and empty. There were some that felt threatening, but the one that stood out to her was one through which she could see Europe from above. She said that there were no borders, no barbed wire fences, nothing. It was all just Europe unified. This was, you'll remember, while the Berlin Wall still stood and divided Germany into East and West. Sam told her that the world would not end in her lifetime. There would be no nuclear war in her lifetime, and Europe wouldn't be split for long. Again, during the Cold War, the threat of nuclear war was ever present and very real. Suddenly, Faye was back in the park with her friends, like she had never left at all. She asked her friends how long she'd been gone, and they seemed to have no idea what she was talking about. The next visit was in 1984 in the Isle of Wight town of Newport, where Faye was visiting her boyfriend. She was walking to his house when Sam suddenly appeared. He was dressed more like a human and walked more normally, quote, not hopping, not using his jerky motions that he had in the past, end quote. Sam even spoke more human-like and was easier to understand. He said he didn't have a lot of time and was using, quote, one of his visits to do this for her. He warned her not to visit her boyfriend and told her to turn around right away and go home. And then he disappeared behind a fence. That night, her boyfriend and some of his friends were arrested for robbery. Faye told Paul she was convinced Sam had saved her from getting caught up in her boyfriend's trouble. Although, as the Oracle in the Matrix might wonder, would he have participated in the robbery if Faye had been there?
Oh, what's really going to bake your noodle later on is, would you still have broken it if I hadn't said anything?
The final visit was in 1989. Faye was newly married and getting ready to move to the mainland with her husband. One afternoon, she got the urge to go for a walk in the forest when something caught her attention. A hut that looked, quote, like a futuristic train carriage, long and white with a roof of corrugated iron, almost as if something had dropped it out of the sky from nowhere. Then she saw Sam, looking more like he did when she first met him. He invited her in for tea. Her tea was poured into a cup that looked like porcelain, but, quote, when she took it in her hands, she said it was super light and pliable, like she could squeeze it and it would not crush, but kind of conform to her hand. They spoke for a while, but she couldn't remember what about, except that he told her the Berlin Wall would fall before the end of the year. Spoiler alert, it did. She also said she asked where he was from and what his true form was, to which he said, from this place, but different. That was the last time she saw him. She couldn't remember what they talked about? Are you for real? Now, I have a couple of things I need to point out about Paul A.T. Wilson that you won't hear on all the Dude Bro podcasts that have covered this so far. One, Paul calls himself a folklorist, and that's all well and good, but he has not published a single book or article that I could find about folklore, or any other subject for that matter. Now, one doesn't have to be a published author to identify by any vocation. However, Paul's website, podcast, and YouTube channel, none of which have been updated since 2023, don't feature a single story about the Sandown Clown. As far as I can tell, last year when he came forward with claims that Faye had reached out to him was the first time he made any public mention of the Sandown Clown. If this is true, then two. Why would Faye have reached out to him? I don't know a ton about folklorists, but I'd venture a guess that there are one or two others with more heft behind their names to whom reaching out would have made more sense. And to that point, why had several other women come to him claiming to be Faye? What was it about this guy that Faye and her imposters, band name I call it, flocked to him instead of, I don't know, anyone from the Folklore Society, for example? 3. Paul's presentation, The Sandown Clown Declassified, isn't available anywhere online, not even for purchase. All we have are the few interviews he's done on Dude Bro podcasts. 4. Paul claims that Faye gave him the notebook Sam had had in his first encounter with Faye and the other little boy, the one in which he wrote, "Hello, and I am all colors, Sam." Or at least she showed it to him. And of this, all we have is his word. There is no proof. Why on earth would Faye's father, Mr. Y, not have shared the notebook with Bufora? Why is 2025 the first time we're hearing that Faye was given the notebook? She doesn't say he gave it to her in any of the subsequent visits. And 5, Paul also claimed in at least one interview that there was one other source that reported on the first encounter at the same time that Bufora did, but he doesn't say what the publication was, and I haven't found a single contemporary source aside from the article in Bufora. I'm not saying that Paul Wilson is lying, but I guess I'm also not saying that he's lying. If someone came to me with a truly unbelievable story like this, I wouldn't just go on the Dude Bro podcast circuit with it. I wouldn't just be like, take my word for it. What is my word worth? Why would I expect anyone to believe me? I have had plenty of people reach out to me with their own stories of the strange and unexplained, but I don't just put them on my show. You have to have some kind of something to show for it. But we're all just supposed to believe Paul Wilson because... why? No, she gave me the notebook. Okay, let's see it. Where's the beef, Paul?
Where's the beef?
So who or what is slash was Sam the Sandown Clown? Well, of course, theories abound. Let's set aside for now the possibility that the entire thing was made up just for the sake of argument. I suppose the most obvious explanation, the Occam's razor of it all, would be that Sam was just a person in a clown costume. In a blog piece from 2021, aptly called Sam the Sandown Clown, author and teacher Tom Quackenbush rightly asks, to what end might a person be galumping through the English countryside in a weird clown costume? So that he might, quote, accidentally encounter two children while wearing a confusing costume, invite them to a two-story shed, show them a magic trick with a berry, and then say goodbye? If it were not for the children, all it would have been was a person in a costume squelching about in the muck of the English countryside for reasons known only to themselves. The evidence against this is primarily physical, namely that the clown was an unlikely 7 feet tall and had 3 fingers and toes. These would be odd and challenging things to fake, particularly if one had no reason to believe one would have an audience. In short, there does not seem to be much reason to conclude this was a hoax, as it would require the hoaxer to have precognitive abilities, a crude clown mask and costume, and a portable two-story metal shed at the ready. Should we consider that wearing a clown costume was simply some strange person's hobby and these children happened upon them at the wrong time? It seems a reach, end quote. I couldn't have said it better myself, which is why I didn't. Plus, also, if it was just a person in a costume, why didn't the two workmen see him? Suggestions that Sam might have been an alien generally get written off because there were no UFO sightings in the area at the time, though who knows? Maybe the windowless hut was his spacecraft? But also, who ever heard of an alien dressed like a clown? As for a lack of other corroborating stories, a piece on the website Cryptopia from 2018 titled Sam the Sandown Ghost Clown offers this sinister thought. Quote, just because Faye and her pal managed to make it out of Sam's strange shed doesn't necessarily mean that was always the case. In fact, while the lack of additional reports might mean that this was just a one-shot deal, it might also mean that the other kids who ran into these inhuman ghost clowns never got the chance to tell their stories. End quote. Perhaps, though, Sam wasn't an alien, but was our planet's alien investigators, the so-called Men in Black. Apparently, according to a piece on HuffPost from 2017, on September 11, 1976, one Dr. Herbert Hopkins, who happened to be researching UFOs at the time, was home in Maine when he received a visit from a man who, quote, wore a neatly tailored black suit, black shoes, black socks, a white shirt with black tie, and he wore a black derby. You don't see derbies very often, and I thought to myself, this guy looks just like an undertaker. When he sat down, he removed his derby. This character was as bald as an egg. He didn't even have eyebrows or eyelashes. It looked like he had smooth plastic skin, like a doll, except that it was a dead white color. His lips were a brilliant ruby red, and he spoke in an expressionless, monotone, scanning speech. He constructed no phrases and sentences, just a sequence of words evenly spaced. His voice was completely passive with no inflection or intonation, as if you were hearing it from a machine that could talk. Then I could see that his mouth was a perfectly straight slit. Apparently, he did not have what we call lips, so the lipstick was put on as a decoy. His mouth was more like a ventriloquist's dummy, end quote. I don't know what to say about this. It's hard to believe that government agents who are trying to be as inconspicuous as possible would look like Tommy Lee Jones or Will Smith, let alone like this. Also, Dr. Hopkins didn't notice this person's extremely strange appearance until after he removed his hat. Like, a guy that looks like this shows up at your door and your first thought is, who wears a derby in this day and age? My favorite theory comes from the website Boojum and Snark, which seems to be a cultural event space in Sandown with a, quote, focus on exhibitions and placemaking projects that resonate with the town's cultural heritage, as well as subculture club events. Quote, Ringo Starr and David Essex were both right here on the island in 1973 filming That'll Be the Day. We know Ringo had an interest in clowns and even sported clown makeup on occasion. He had a penchant for platform shoes. If you refer to the description of Sam, could his antennae be wooden drumsticks? And David Essex's character in the film famously throws his books into a stream, a bizarre echo of our Sandown clown's own encounter with a book in the water. Could Sam have been a celebrity caught in a moment of eccentric research or OTT method acting? End quote. I mean, I doubt Ringo Starr was just running around on the outskirts of a golf course with no film crew in sight, but stranger things have happened. Some have suggested a folie à deux, or a shared delusion between two people. Maybe. Or maybe it was just two young children doing what young children are supposed to do, making believe. Maybe the man who laughed at Faye as she ran home from the encounter is a red herring. Maybe he did laugh, but who knows? Maybe that's not the reason she didn't tell her father right away. Maybe she got distracted on her way home and something 3 weeks later reminded her of the fun make-believe session she'd had with her friend, and she told her dad about it the way little children do. The argument that her use of detail meant that it had to be true is ridiculous. First of all, one of the best ways to know someone is lying is when they add too much detail. I have a friend who is terrible at coming up with excuses for canceling dates. She'll be like, I'll just tell him that I got a phone call yesterday around noon from my cat's doctor, and they said they had a sudden opening to see my cat, whose name is Mr. Tinky Pants, by the way. He's been acting really weird lately, and I've been trying to get him to the vet, and also the vet is like an hour away, so I have to take Mr. Tinky Pants, and I don't know how long it's going to take, because also I have a flat tire, so I have to get that fixed, but I don't get paid until Tuesday, so I have to wait, so I can't make it to the date. Girl, just say your cat is sick. Also, Faye's dad was already ready to believe. All he needed to say was what kind of hair did he have, and Faye would add the detail that he was balding. For me, the detail of the two workmen nearby is what makes this story fall apart. If you're the kind of person who thinks that detail adds credence, more power to you. I want to live in your world. But now you want me to believe that this thing, whatever it was, picked these two children out of everyone to reveal itself to and was invisible to everyone else? I'm inclined to agree with the guy from Vice, which is not a thing I ever thought I would say, who put it this way. Quote, the most obvious explanation is that the Sandown clown was pure fantasy made up by a little girl encouraged by her gullible father. The whole tale feels like something you might end up with if you asked a child the question, and then what happened, over and over again until the whole narrative has been unfurled. It could also have been fueled by the unsettling images of BBC test cards F and G, which would have been running on British television at that time, perhaps implanting themselves into the subconscious when observed early in the morning or late at night in that hazy liminal space between wakefulness and dream, end quote. Test cards were images that ran on the BBC channels beginning in 1967 when there was nothing programmed to run. It had something to do with helping stations make sure their settings were right or something. I don't know. Anyway, test card F was an image of a girl playing tic-tac-toe with a clown that happened to look a lot like what Faye described Sam looking like. In the end, I think this is Much Ado About Nothing. But I also think it's kind of beautiful and amazing that what was most likely just the imaginings of a creative little girl has lasted this long and taken on a life of its own. In this age of photographic evidence, it's easy to forget that for the vast majority of human history, all we had was the spoken word. Who's to say which stories are real and which are made up? I'd wager that most of the stories we tell are some combination of truth and fiction. Perhaps what matters most in the cases of stories of fairies or goblins or alien ghost clowns is not what is true or not, but rather why those stories stick with us and become a part of the fabric of history on their way. Strangers, we're dark next week and we'll run a classic episode from the vault. We'll be back the week of March 16th with the fascinating story of Cassie Chadwick, who scammed millions of dollars out of unsuspecting folks, all, somehow, while being unattractive. Can you even imagine? Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Keely Hies. Sound engineering and design by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode or want to submit a question for an Ask Me Anything episode, head to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Eventually, I need an assistant. You can follow me on social media at Daisy Egan or follow the show at SNU Pod and Grab Bag Collab. Stay strange.